I'll never forget the summer when my family got our first television set. It was 1956. I was about to turn 10. Having lived in Arkansas my whole life, TV opened up a whole new world to me. Of course, I loved the cartoons and the kids' shows like Captain Kangaroo and Howdy Doody, but I also loved watching baseball games with players I was captivated by, especially Willie Mays and Mickey Mantle. And I was, believe it or not, totally enthralled at that tender age by the Democratic and Republican conventions held that summer. 65 years later, Hillary and I, like lots of people, find that one of our favorite ways to relax and unwind after a long day, or in this case, after a long isolation after COVID, is just to sit down and turn on the TV, sometimes binge, look at our favorite shows. So why am I telling you this? Because good television has always been about entertainment, yes, but it's done more. It's introduced us to stories and characters we may have never known. And we see them and come to understand people who identify with those stories and characters. In the process, we enable them to be seen, heard, and respected, maybe for the first time in their lives. Good television can really help all of us to develop more empathy and understanding, to see things from a different perspective, especially during a year like we've just experienced, when so many people have felt isolated. Good TV can also keep us connected. It can bring us relief and joy, sometimes when we need it most. But it takes a visionary writer to imagine those stories and to create those characters, an incredible skill to make them so compelling that people want to invite them into their lives episode after episode. Today, I'm honored to be joined by a pioneering woman who has done just that, maybe better than anyone ever has, Shonda Rhimes. You probably know Shonda as the producer of groundbreaking shows like Grey's Anatomy, Scandal, How to Get Away with Murder, Station 19, and Bridgerton, and perhaps as the best-selling author of her memoir, Year of Yes. From her very first television project, a documentary about my friend, the late Hank Aaron, to her production company, Shondaland, and her work with Netflix, she has become one of the most prolific, respected, and successful creators in the history of entertainment. She's been honored with the Peabody Award, a Golden Globe. She's been inducted into the Television Academy of Arts and Sciences Hall of Fame. She's also been honored by the Directors Guild of America, GLAAD, and the NAACP for diversity and representation on her television shows. Just as she's created new ways to tell stories in what may seem like familiar settings, she's focused her philanthropic work on changing the narrative around what a philanthropist looks like and finding ways to make sure others have opportunities to realize their own talents and live their own dreams. Shonda, thanks so much for being here today.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. This is exciting.
I know that many of our listeners, most of our listeners, know some of your characters at least very well and where they came from. But mostly they know you as you are today. So tell us more about where you came from. How did you get here? Where does your own story start? What drove you? How did you break into this business?
That's a big question. I think for me, you know, I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago. I'm the youngest of six children. And my parents are both educators. And because of that, you know, they both work in academia. Because of my parents working in academia, I think I always felt like education was important. And we were always sort of, as children of color growing up in this world, like kind of required to be our best and be successful. And that's not a bad thing, but it did make me feel like things like writing or being an artist weren't real jobs. You know, going to grad school was a job. Being a lawyer was a job. Being, you know, a doctor was a job. But being a writer was not a job. And so it never really occurred to me that I could earn a living doing this job. I wanted desperately to be somebody like Toni Morrison when I'd read her novels, or a poet or something like that. But it wasn't until I was, I want to say like 19 or 20 that I realized that you could make a living writing television shows. Like that was an actual job that people could have and that telling stories could be a way of earning a living. I still didn't think that was something I could do, but it felt like, oh, okay, that's possible. And I remember graduating from college and feeling a little bit lost. I'd gone to Dartmouth College. My parents had spent a great deal of money for me to go there, and I wanted to make them proud. And I didn't know what to do. And I read that it was harder to get into USC film school than it was to get into Harvard Law School. And I thought, well, my parents can't find fault with that. And I applied, and I got in. And what was great about it was I could tell my parents, well, I'm going to use that graduate degree to teach. You know, I can teach. That's a real thing. And my parents felt like, okay, she's in academia. That feels safe, and it makes sense to us. And so that was sort of my start. And film school felt like, I don't know, it felt normal to me. It felt like I'd found a place where I belonged.
I think most people probably don't think about how you go from an idea to writing to putting on a show and running it. And when you became a showrunner, suddenly you're thrust into running a business. You've got hundreds of employees. And now with several shows in production at the same time, it's almost like running a mini economy. I've heard you say the process is like creating a nation out of thin air. So how do you balance the relatively isolated craft of writing with managing hundreds of people? And has managing all these people to turn an idea into reality affected how you write and how you think about characters?
I think when I first broke into the business, you know, I was doing screenplays. My first job was sort of as a research director on the Hank Aaron documentary that you mentioned. So those are very isolated jobs. You know, if you're writing a screenplay or you're doing the research direction on a documentary or things like that, you're by yourself at home in your pajamas doing the work. And then I wrote, I thought I'll write a television show. That sounds like fun. I really think that's where all the character growth is happening. And I tried 1 year and I wrote a pilot about journalists. And, well, it was about war correspondents, and we went to war. And I thought, well, nobody wants to go watch war correspondents when we're actually going to war in real life. And then the next year, I wrote a show about medical doctors, about surgeons. And that was Grey's Anatomy. So truly, I had never worked in the television business before at all. And I wrote Grey's Anatomy. And so to go from not just being thrust into running a business with hundreds of people, but never having had any experience in the television industry at all. So going from being at home in your pajamas, really, writing movies, to being thrust into running a business with hundreds of people was very startling because it's a completely different animal than a film. In a film, the director is in charge. They say the director fires the writer. And in television, the writer is in charge. They say the writer fires the director. And suddenly, I had all of this responsibility at my fingertips. You know, people wanted to know, you know, how are we going to do this? Is it going to be on budget? You're responsible for people's jobs. You're responsible for people's livelihoods. You're not just a storyteller. You're responsible for like a mini economy. It's really true. And your job is to keep that train on the track, keep the shows being made and keep people employed, but also keep the network making their, you know, money that they're supposed to be making, and you want their advertising dollars to be high. It's a real business. And it truly, you obviously, in a way that I could never know, you have run a country. So it's nothing like that. It is this very small feeling of having all eyes on you, very miniaturized, tiny, tiny way, and you wanting to do good, and learning that you have to speak up. And I had to learn how to become a leader, and I had to learn how to take care of the people around me, and to really realize that that was part of my job.
Another problem you have dealt with mostly in your memoir, Year of Yes, is the challenges of pursuing that career, handling all those extra responsibilities, and still being a good mother. And how at each step that where you're doing something newer and bigger, you have to overcome shyness, fear of failure, whatever it is that keeps most of us from being everything we could be. So tell us about your saying yes philosophy and how it helped you both as a mother and as a leader.
I do think we are taught as a society to say no, to be careful, to be that strong often means being careful and doing everything exactly right, which keeps you a lot of times from saying yes to things that could be frightening to you. And by frightening, I mean, I've never done that before, so I'm scared to do it. And so because of that, you hide from doing things that you should be doing. So for me, the whole memoir Year of Yes came about because one Thanksgiving, I was sort of bragging to my sister about all of these fancy invitations I'd received to go places. And she said, but you're never going to go. And I said, well, of course not. You know, I can't. And she said, you never say yes to anything. And I realized that she was right. Like, I was so shy, but also so careful about like not wanting to step out of my comfort zone. I was doing, you know, one or two things and I was doing them well. That was it. So I just kept myself saying no, just it felt safer. And I do think for most young women, it feels like that's how you get through. You keep yourself in your comfort zone and you do the things that you're good at. And what was very interesting for me was that I feel like my life, when I say completely changed, I mean completely changed when I decided that I was going to spend a year saying yes to everything that scared me. And I was scared of a lot of things, I have to say. Like, I was afraid of public speaking. I was afraid to think of myself as somebody who should be out in front. I was afraid of so many things. And the first thing that I got asked to do was to give a commencement speech at Dartmouth in front of thousands of people, which was terrifying. But what I discovered through this whole process was that the very act of doing the thing that you are afraid of sort of undoes the fear. It's amazing. You sort of step through this thing and you think, well, it's never going to work. It's going to be awful. And the minute you're in the middle of it, you realize you can no longer be afraid of a thing that you're already doing. And it frees you in an amazing way. So I started saying yes to more things. And one of the other things I did that I think sort of made my work life better was that I started saying yes to my children. And at the time, they were very little. They were like 3 and 5 or maybe 2 and 4 and 13, whenever they asked me if I wanted to play. And, you know, little kids ask that all the time and you're busy and you think like, I have too much to do. I'm working on this. I'm that. So instead, I would stop whatever I was doing and play with my kids. And, you know, children only really want to play with you for about 15 minutes before they want to do something else. But it was knowing that I was saying yes to them that gave them this level of comfort. It was knowing that they didn't have to worry, like, is mom going to have the time for us? That somehow made them not necessarily need to ask me to play all the time. They just knew I was there for them. And for me, it brought me this sense of joy. Like, I learned how to play again in a real way. And I admitted this. I gave a TED Talk and I admitted this on the stage where I said, I don't actually like playing. Like the idea of like the Barbie dolls and the things that kids do. I think they're cool, but I'm not a person who wants to play. I like to spend time in my head imagining, reading books. I was always that way. And I learned how to play, like building Legos and putting together, you know, little houses and drawing things with crayons and, you know, making sandcastles and all the things, you know, playing hide and seek, playing pretend, playing dress up, all the things that I would never have done, I have done now as a grown woman with my kids because they wanted to do it. And I've had a great time. And I feel like it opened me up creatively in so many ways. I don't know. I mean, I think children change you fundamentally. And sometimes we're so busy trying to be successful that we're resistant to some of those changes, or we're careful about them. And it was just a life-changing experience. The entire act of saying yes was a life-changing experience.
That's wonderful. You know, I read many years ago a study, I can't even remember who did it, but someone followed all these kids who had really succeeded in their lives against enormous obstacles. And the only conclusion that the researcher could draw was that somehow people make it, they can grow into themselves if, when they're young, they believe they're the most important person in the world to somebody. And the most important somebody is obviously a parent. I think that it's also life-affirming for the parent. And it's wonderful. I loved what you said about that in your book. We'll be right back. You know, Hillary and I binge-watched Grey's Anatomy for years, and we TiVo'd everything. So we were faithful watchers. I still check in on them every now and then. I feel like I know these people. The thing that means the most to me today about your characters, and I'd like to talk to you about it, is that you don't paint people in black and white. You do nuance. You do shades of reality. You don't turn your heroes or your villains into two-dimensional cartoons. And I think one of the things that's really hurting America today and all over the world, and one of the reasons for the rise of all this rampant, divisive nationalism, is that we're all being turned into cartoons. And it's happening in every aspect of our life, including the way we get normal news information. I mean, when John Kennedy was president, the news was an hour long. There were three networks, enough to keep each other honest in competition, but also to keep each other financially and psychologically secure enough that they could tell a story. The average time when the president was on television in a news story, the average exposure was 43 seconds. By the time I became president, it was down to about 18. By the time Barack Obama became president, it was down to about 9. As it kept dropping, it was tailor-made for someone like Donald Trump. I thought the most valuable thing about Scandal, and in a different way about your other shows, How to Get Away with Murder, and especially about Grey's Anatomy, the only reason these lasted for 17 years, I think, is that the people are inherently interesting because they are constantly revealing themselves in ways that are surprising. It turns out we're not cartoons. And when we navigate the world as if we are, it seems to me we're creating a hell of a problem for ourselves in a world that's tough enough as it is. Do you think about that?
I think about that all the time. And I find myself having that conversation more and more all the time. There's something to me about sort of what I call the struggle it takes to remain human that feels vital in storytelling. First, I'm going to say that you once sent me a letter saying that you really enjoyed watching, you and Hillary really enjoyed watching Grey's Anatomy. And I framed it. And it was for a long time in my office, the only thing framed and hung on my wall. I was very excited. It was like, it meant a lot. And then as a gift, I think you said something in an interview once where you said, "I just love everything Shonda Rhimes does." And my staff got me a t-shirt that said, "Bill Clinton loves everything I do." And I wore it. It was really cute. But it also was like this affirmation. So thank you for that. Now, I'm going to go back to your question. This idea that people are not just these two-dimensional paper, you know, doll cutouts, that everybody has a humanity to them, that everybody has, you know, pain and sorrow and love and joy, that everyone believes they're the hero of their own story, that they're not just acting because they're villains or because they're, you know, like the love interest. Every character that you're writing about has to be the hero of their own story, and you have to treat them that way, is a really important thing, both in storytelling, I think, and in life. It was very interesting for me in Scandal, which I'd created as sort of a fable. You know, when I created Scandal, my idea was that Washington was so not like that. There was no way Washington was like that, that it was kind of going to be fun to explore what the dark, dark side of politics could be. This idea that really that they were sort of the monsters among us running our country and we had missed it. But it's always fun to tell, you know, a ghost story, you know, when the lights are on. But then we moved to a place in their country where the lights were off and it stopped being as much fun. But those characters, all of them, you know, Cyrus Bean was a very dark character and a very sort of, people used to say like, oh, he's so evil. And I would get very offended. And I would say, Cyrus Bean is not evil. Cyrus Bean is a patriot. Because in his own mind, that is why he was doing what he was doing. He was doing it because he loved his country more than anybody else in his mind, and that he was doing everything he could to save his country more than anybody else. Every last character has to be somebody who you can step in their shoes and walk around. Every story has to provide a window and a mirror so you can look through and see somebody else's life and also see yourself in there. And we should be treating other people currently like that too. And I find myself having this conversation more and more because the generation that's coming up right now, I think they've been conditioned to not look at the world that way, unfortunately. And I get a lot of pushback when I say, you know, Donald Trump, whatever he's done, you have to look at him like a person and think, if I was walking in his shoes, what would that mean? As hard as that may be for somebody. And to them, that's like I'm saying, you know, set yourself on fire or something equally as ridiculous, because it's very hard for them to believe that things are not black and white, that there are these shades of gray out there, you know?
You know, I would always tell people, this is the framework through which I evaluate this. You may not agree with it. That's fine. But if you don't, you need your own framework, because you need to understand. It's more important to understand before you take a side. And when you take a side, if you want to avoid calamity, you have to understand the other side. When I was president, my staff used to laugh at me because I never made an argument when I wanted Boris Yeltsin to do something or to convince the Yitzhak Rabin or Shimon Peres or Bibi Netanyahu to do something. I would never argue about why I wanted it. I always stated why I thought it was best for them to do it. I said, you may not agree. You know your own interests more than me, but here's why I think it's good for you. I think we just don't do that enough anymore. I remember when I was 13 years old, so this has been more than 60 years ago. I remember this like it was yesterday. In my last day of eighth grade science, my teacher, Vernon Doakey, who was an ex-coach, he was married to a beautiful woman who taught me history and was great. He, to put it charitably, was not a handsome man. And teachers didn't make any money, and he was always trying to let out his belt and coming out of his shirt. And he had a Coke bottle glasses, and he smoked cheap cigars out of a little plastic cigar holder, which aggravated his beak, nose, and pinched his face. So we're getting ready to end our career in eighth grade science. He said, kid, you're not going to remember anything you learned in eighth grade science, but you should remember this. Every morning I get up and I go into the bathroom and I throw water on my face and I shave and then I wash the cream off and I dry my face and I look in that mirror and I say, Vernon, you're beautiful. He said, if you remember that one thing, everybody wants to believe they're beautiful. It'll take you a long way in life. And here we are 62 years later, and I remember like it was yesterday.
I love that because I think he's right. I really do. I think it's that self-belief that's what makes people believe. People are the stories they tell themselves. I mean, that's part of it. And I don't know. I mean, I find it really interesting when you tell me that the news has changed so much that, you know, the number of seconds a president has been on television has deteriorated so much. But I also find it interesting, like, there used to be rules, right, where the news had to present both sides, and that was done away with at some point. And once that was done away with, the news stopped being the news and started being a certain form of entertainment, almost like just more reality television, which I think is very difficult. And I think there's no time in the news anymore, and most people who are watching don't have time. They're just trying to get by in life. And I feel like if they had a way of, I don't know, connecting with the people on the other side of the world by at least understanding what was going on in a more more explained way, I don't know, things would be better a little bit. What do you think it's going to take to, like, do you think that what's going on right now in the government is really going to help to change sort of this idea that people want to be more entertained than they do taken care of or saved or engaged in the world?
I think Biden has been almost pitch perfect in what he said and done. I think the problem he has is, first of all, the last election was very close. And I think that it's now a performance art for the Democrats. If we can produce positive results that cross those divides by lifting everybody, giving everybody a chance, then we have a chance to psychologically change. It's very hard to change the political standoff that exists today because the Republicans believe it's working for them. And that's the big challenge. But I think that Biden has done it very well. I think he's made good decisions economically and good decisions on staff and good decisions to have an inclusive policy economically and socially and politically. And you just have to keep reaching out to the Republicans. And at the moment they believe they have more to gain by making a deal than just saying no all the time, then he should show a little leg too, and they can maybe do something. But he's been doing this a long time, and he knows that they think they're winning even though he won and even though he's popular. So he can only get back to bipartisanship when they're willing to do it. And I notice in South America, I had a couple of elections recently, and one a left-winger won and the other a right-winger won, and in both cases they won because they weren't of the party that was in before, because people know what we're doing is not working. And so they said, what have I got to lose by changing? But that's the sort of mindset. And people that love your programs, and I want to get back to that, they like them because even if they're watching a highly improbable plot, they're not watching highly improbable people.
Oh, that's interesting. I never thought of it that way.
Would there be a market for a political show that tried to deal with this stuff?
I absolutely think there would. I mean, I don't know if you ever saw that there was an amazing show called Borgen that was out years and years ago.
Hillary and I binge watched that. We love Borgen.
Borgen's amazing. But I kept thinking, there is a world in which something like that could be so interesting now and here, because we are at this very odd place in the story of America, really, if you look at it that way. You know, we've come to a very strange crossroads, and that crossroad, it's ripe for drama, first of all. But even just the plain facts of it, there was things that I always said at the end of Scandal, when we were writing, I would say, well, we've written something that's so crazy. It's never going to, you know, happen. And then it would happen. And that was worrisome to me. But we are at a place where I constantly say, we can't make this up. Like, this can't be made up. But I think this past year, this pandemic, the political uprising, the racial justice reckoning, all of those things, the being forced inside, people losing their jobs, all the things that happened that sort of kept everybody in a more contemplative place have made people more interested or more reflective about the world that we're in. That I do feel is true. Whichever way they're leaning, they're more passionate about what they're leaning towards. And so at least I feel like they're more interested in the narrative. And maybe there's something in that. If you can understand somebody, I think they you can embrace them and you can see another side of the world.
We'll be right back. When you write a TV show, or you produce one, or you lead one, like, did you have any idea Bridgerton was going to be as successful as it was?
My feeling about shows that we make, I know that if I want to watch them, I mean, we made it, so I was there in the editing room, and I was there when we were working on the scripts. But if I still want to watch it, I feel like it's going to be popular. That doesn't mean I know it is, but I always try to make shows that I want to watch. So did I know it was going to be that popular? No. But I did feel good about it at the very least. I always feel like as long as I want to like sell the episodes out of the back of my car just to get people to watch something, then we have a fighting chance. But that was out of this world extraordinary how big that show was. I don't know that any of us could have imagined that.
Well, you know, we're just fairly late in the game. Hillary and I were home on a Saturday afternoon, and we had dinner, and we started watching it. She'd been wanting to watch it, and she said, I just want to watch an episode, and then we'll go to bed. And then, well, let's watch another one. The sun was coming up Sunday morning when we finished it. We watched it all the way through, and I realized that, among other things, I liked the Queen Charlotte character. I thought she played it well and she was great. And I realized I didn't know, that's a big chunk of history I didn't know. I thought I knew virtually everything relevant about George III and I didn't have a clue. So is it going to be hard to keep it going? And are we ever going to see Rhaegar Jean again?
It's not going to be hard to keep going because they're based on the books of Julia Quinn. And Julia's written, you know, the Bridgerton family is 8 children and she's written 8 books, one for each kid. So we've got a lot of material to work with, which is really great. And we've added some interesting characters. You know, we added Queen Charlotte into the storylines and things. I don't know that any of us expected the magic that Rhaegar was going to bring to the screen. I think that was electrifying. He brought such a depth and a soulfulness to that role and an excitement that I thought was amazing. And I just don't think I expected it. I don't think he expected it, you know, to one day be living his life and the next day to not be able to walk down the street. But that was magical. And I mean, I always say to people, like, you know, the Duke is never gone. He's just sort of waiting to be binge-watched all over again. But we really only, you know, the whole idea is that, and this is very different for television, that we're going to tell a close-ended love story every season is exciting to me. Because then you don't have to come up with fake reasons why the couple can't be together anymore. You get to actually fulfill the story that was meant to be told and then let them go on. So that's kind of the plan.
Well, I remember the only, it was amazing. Hillary just kept saying over and over again all night long, that's the most beautiful man I ever saw on television. I kept wanting to get bumped off after a while. It was amazing. And it was a brilliant show. And the other characters were good. But I think we all learned something watching it.
I think I really enjoyed the way we used it to explore character. And I liked the way we played with people's expectations of who the characters could be. I was very proud of that. And there's some beautiful British actors that you just never get to see do these roles. And you know, Lady Danbury, like getting to see that actor play that role was just spectacular.
Are there any characters that you tried to bring to the screen that you wish you had, that you still might? Anything?
One of the things that we're working on is Warmth of Other Suns with Anna Deavere Smith. And I desperately want to see that brought to life because I know how magical that will be. But also it feels like there's this great responsibility behind that one. But I don't know. I mean, I like an interesting tale told and I like an interesting character. I don't necessarily have any ones that I'm specifically holding on to or waiting for.
Let's talk a little bit about your philanthropic work. I noticed in your philanthropy, you support Time's Up. And I like that because it's both an attempt to end abuse against women in the workplace and an attempt to build a more inclusive, healthy workplace and teach people, let them learn, let them grow, let them build a different future together. How did you decide to support the organizations you do? And do you believe that at a time when government has to do more than ever before, since the Depression, that it still matters that people are doing this non-governmental work?
I mean, I don't ever think, I'm always going to think philanthropy matters. I just am. I think that people who have the means and the ability to be engaged in helping other people is always going to be important. I think that what matters about philanthropy is making sure that the funds that are being donated or the ways that you're helping people are really about how the other people want to be helped versus how you think they should be helped, which I see a lot. And I think that the idea of celebrating a different kind of philanthropy is also important. You know, there's a whole world of philanthropy that really sort of is sort of surrounded by this, you know, these particular people are our big philanthropist people, and that's kind of it. And I was talking to Darren Walker of the Ford Foundation, and I said to him, I think if we're only going to believe that philanthropy belongs to old white men, philanthropy is going to die with all of the old rich white men, if we put it that way. It has to be something that we're passing down to younger generations as their responsibility too, and as a rewarding responsibility. So for me, you know, a lot of the things I like to support are about, you know, young people in the arts, helping young people of color sort of find a place for themselves in the arts, things that have to do with women's issues, Time's Up, and, you know, Planned Parenthood and those things. Obviously, you know, I have my political things that I support, but I do think that for me, it's about finding things that I am really passionate about and really care about and believe in, and then focusing on that versus, I know some people spread themselves too thin, you know, which I feel like is a danger. In the beginning, I wasn't sure what to do or who to give to, but I really learned to focus on the things that really felt important to me. Because a lot of things feel important to you, but it's hard to find, to define it and hone it down. And I also think what's important is being a partner with the organizations that you're working with and trying to serve them as best you can in whatever way you can.
That's what I liked about our Clinton Global Initiative model. You know, we would just help people to find partners who could implement things in areas they were interested in and then listen to the people before they gave them the money. So they'd be empowered but not directive. And I think, you know, it works pretty well. And I try to find things that aren't being done, that fall into the gap between what government can provide and the private sector will produce, either because there's a financial gap or because people's attitudes won't permit them to do what needs to be done.
I think over the past year, one of the things that I've been most, that I've learned the most about, I spent a lot of time learning about, was what's going on with education in America, or the lack thereof, and how much it affects prosperity and how much it affects future needs, you know, K through three education plus preschool through K three education or college education, both of which are so vital and important. I've been working with an organization called Beyond 12, which I love because they sort of help get kids who are first-generation college kids all the way through, through their college experience and really make sure that they have all the resources they need and all the support that they need to become college graduates, which I think is important. But for me this year, really, I mean, after trying to homeschool my children for maybe 5 minutes by myself, really understanding the need of any parent with a special needs child or anything being without the help that they deserve and the qualities of different public schooling, that to me feels like the biggest area that worries me about America right now. Other than people, you know, children obviously going hungry in our own country. But there's so many issues. That's the thing. There are so many issues that have to be addressed, almost too many.
I think in the long run, that may be your most important project, that Beyond 12. Because we know that starting at about 13, if kids get that far without developing the necessary basic skills, they get very bored with school because they don't really know what's going on, and they begin to drift away. And they begin to develop lower expectations of themselves. And I think that maybe when we can get back to something that approximates normal life and we get the economy working for more people anyway, there'll be an even greater market for what you're trying to do there, because it's really important. I mean, these kids, 13 is a very hard year for a lot of kids.
It definitely was for me.
I want our listeners to know that you need to find something that you care about and help, and you don't have to have all the money in the world to make a difference in a lot of them, but it's a very good thing. Well, I didn't get you to say anything you shouldn't have said about Bridgerton. Your programs have been your shows have been a gift to millions of us, including me and our family. So I thank you for that. And I wish you well. I hope you'll keep thinking on that. What I said, though, you did something that I haven't seen people do, at least not as well. You made your dark characters have their better spots and your bright characters have their weak spots. And you kept us all in the game of life instead of this crazy cartoonish spats we're having. So I thank you for that. I used to recommend to my listeners when I give these talks a certain number of books that were short enough that, you know, I wasn't asking to War and Peace their way to truth. But E.O. Wilson, the great microbiologist who's about 90 now, and insofar as was possible, he traced back through all of human and pre-human history, and he said the most successful species that have ever occupied our Earth are ants, termites, bees, and people. Because in the face of repeated opportunities to destroy themselves, they have always found new habits of cooperation which enable them to overcome and survive and thrive. He said, now people are both the most successful and the most complicated, because alone among these species, they have consciousness and a conscience. Their consciousness takes them a long way, but makes them arrogant. And so far, at every turn, their conscience has kicked in time to save the species. But also, you can teach the same lesson without saying those words in your characters that are, even if imperfect, flawed and wonderful at the same time. You've given us a great gift.
Thank you. That means so much to me coming from you. That's amazing. Thank you.
I've enjoyed this conversation. And is there anything you want to say as we close out?
No, this conversation has been incredible for me. I always feel like when I listen to you talk, I learn something, and I learned a lot in our conversation today. So I appreciate it so much.
You've been wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Why Am I Telling You This is a production of iHeartRadio, the Clinton Foundation, and At Will Media. Our executive producers are Craig Manassian and Will Malnati. Our production team includes Mitch Bluestein, Jameson Katsoufis, Tom Galton, Sarah Horowitz, and Jake Young, with production support from Tyler Scott and Latavia Young. Original music by Watt White. Special thanks to John Sykes, Tina Flannoy, John Davidson, Angel Urena, Corey Gansley, Oscar Flores, Kevin Thurm, and all our dedicated staff and partners at the Clinton Foundation. If you have an idea or suggestion for the show, we'd love to hear from you. So please visit clintonfoundation.org/podcast to share your thoughts with us. If you like the show, tell someone else about it. You can subscribe to Why Am I Telling You This on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast. By listening to this podcast, you're helping support the work of the Clinton Foundation. So thank you.
Hi, I'm Jane Park, Director of National Partnerships at Too Smart to Fail, the Clinton Foundation's Early Learning Initiative. In the United States, nearly 60% of children start kindergarten unprepared, lagging behind in critical language and literacy skills. Luckily, research tells us that simple, everyday interactions like talking, reading, and singing with young children from the moment they're born can help set a strong foundation for lifelong learning. That's why we're working to surround families with early language, literacy, and learning opportunities during their daily routines. From a load at the laundromat, to the bus stop, the pediatrician's office, to the playground, we work to meet parents where they are and help them provide their children with the best possible start in school and in life. Learn more about this work and see how you can get involved. Visit www.clintonfoundation.org/podcast.